protecting Florida from rising seas is going to cost real money. Some critics say that funding shouldn't come at the cost of affordable housing. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, is affordable housing in Florida threatened by a new commitment to resiliency? We'll take a closer look at how the state is planning to spend your taxpayer dollars on all of this. Give us a call now. It's 549-2937. Then later, some positive news and notes for your week in our What's Good Wednesdays. First, though, the latest numbers on the pandemic. Let's begin with the good news. 8.6 million Florida residents have gotten at least one dose of vaccine. 5.3 million have gotten both doses. And fully vaccinated Americans no longer need to wear a mask outside except in crowded settings. That under new guidelines released Tuesday by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Florida is reporting fewer coronavirus cases overall. They added 39,683 new cases to the state's dashboard in the week ending Sunday, but that's down about 11%. Florida also ranked ninth among the states where coronavirus was spreading the fastest on a per-person basis, according to Johns Hopkins University data. So those are all good trend lines, but we do continue to see cases, hospitalizations, and deaths every day. The pandemic isn't over yet, so when you head indoors, mask up, and please go get that vaccine. Our other top story today, Florida could soon redirect hundreds of millions of dollars to efforts to combat sea level rise and work on resiliency measures in the state. Now, increasingly, that is something the majority of voters here say they really want. But at the same time, there is controversy over where some of the money to pay for resiliency efforts will come from. The state's Housing Trust Fund. We're going to talk about this right now as we welcome Missy Howell, president of NEFAR, the Northeast Florida Association of Realtors. Missy, good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you. Also on the line, Diana Galavis. She sits on the Jacksonville Housing and Community Development Commission. That's the local body that distributes these Housing Trust Fund dollars in our community. Hi, Diana.
Hello. Good morning, Melissa.
And we're talking about two competing priorities on the show today, climate change mitigation efforts and affordable housing. Can the state pay for both? If you have questions about this, we want to hear from you. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Missy Howell of NEFAR, let's begin with you. Florida has struggled for a long time to provide people with enough safe, affordable housing. About 70% of Florida's low-income households are cost burdened. That means that more than 30% of their income is spent on housing and utilities. So there's this thing called the State Housing Trust Fund that is supposed to go toward building new affordable housing stock as well as shoring up existing buildings. The state has had a long history of sweeping money out of this fund into other priorities. And now in this session, realtors and people who advocate for affordable housing are concerned because we're seeing this again, but when it comes to resiliency efforts, can you tell us what's happening?
Thank you, Melissa. So we, as realtors, we want resiliency efforts to continue, and we believe these are worthy causes, but not at the expense of taking funds away from providing thousands of families the ability to control their housing expense and get into that first-time home or into a rental situation that they may not otherwise be able to get into. What we don't advocate is that they come into our housing trust fund, which Florida Realtors lobbied to create in 1992. That's where this money came from. It was actually an increase in the sales tax on properties sold, and a portion of that going over into the trust fund. So it was, the tax was put there to fund the source for thousands of families in Florida to be able to afford their first home. So there are other resources that could be available out there. As you said, the legislature has continually gone in and swept this. They saw this account as being low-hanging fruit and said, we'll just go over and reappropriate this money, which has reduced the amount of funds mm-hmm. available for well-qualified buyers, but on the low to moderate income range, to be able to buy their first home.
Let's go to you, Diana. You are part of the Jacksonville Housing Commission. You distribute these trust fund dollars in our area. The leadership in Tallahassee now says they want $200 million for affordable housing in the state. They're sort of reworking this plan to give more money toward affordable housing because there has been so much pushback on this. Can you tell us a little bit more about how this is all going to impact people in our area, however this shakes out?
So the Jacksonville Housing and Community Development Commission is to identify and develop funding streams and financial resources for all phases of affordable housing. So we need as much money as possible,
right?
To say it is bluntly as I possibly can. We provide technical and financial assistance for nonprofits, faith-based organizations, for building more affordable housing around the city. So this is critical. So the housing programs are slated to get $209 million for the next fiscal year. Now that sounds like a lot. We're talking millions of dollars here. But the trust fund is estimated to get $423 million. Let that set in. That is a lot of money that is going to help people get into homes. So basically the argument is that we need environmental infrastructure, for sure. I'm all for that. We live in Florida. We need water quality, and I don't think anybody can argue that. But these affordable housing trust funds were designed to help Floridians achieve stable and affordable housing, whereas the environmental projects that are going to largely benefit all of us, they're not going to help people get into homes. Sea level rise and wastewater projects would strengthen and protect Florida's communities and homes as well, but building a seawall on a coastline or connecting a home to septic to city sewer does not help a Floridian without a home find a home. And that's what these trust funds were meant to do.
You know, it's interesting to look at the numbers. The Florida Senate President Wilton Simpson and the Speaker of the House, Chris Sprouse, the legislation initially wanted to permanently redirect 2/3 of the housing trust funds in Florida each year to sea level rise and wastewater infrastructure projects. As you have been pointing out, ladies, this was money that is supposed to go to affordable housing efforts, teachers, firefighters, nurses, the elderly, first responders, people who need a little help to get into affordable housing. Initially, they wanted to put more than 60% of this housing trust fund to other priorities than housing, which is where the money is supposed to go. They've watered that down somewhat, Missy Howell. But at the same time, I think the question becomes, is this a false choice, as some people are tweeting me right now? They're telling us, listeners, that both environmentalists and affordable housing advocates alike strongly object to sweeping this fund. They say, find other funds for resiliency efforts. So I think these are both worthy efforts that the state needs to prioritize. The question becomes, how do they pay for these competing priorities? How would you like to see the state fund resiliency, given that there's now an amendment in Tallahassee that would prevent the legislature from taking money out of this housing trust fund all the time, which they've used it like a slush fund for many years? If they're not able to do that anymore, how then would you like to see the state look at resiliency measures?
So one of the things that needs to be considered that I don't think was considered, because both were both at the state level while they were drafting this plan, on the federal level, the plans for the American Rescue Plan Act of 2021 is being drafted. There are significant funds that will be allocated from the American Rescue Plan Act of 2021 that will go specifically to sea level rise and other infrastructure projects within the state. That's a more immediate source of funding that would, you know, can go and help the state do these projects and help us to keep those funds intact. We have, especially across the state of Florida, we have a growing affordable housing issue. We have a wonderful climate, both tax and weather. In Northeast Florida, we enjoy a wide diversity of jobs here. All of these things are creating, they've created a magnet for people moving in high tax areas, high density areas, out of state, as well as they're tired of the cold weather, right? And so they're looking, well, where can we go to move? They're coming to Florida. So that puts that demand on housing here. As we learned, you know, in school a long time ago, supply and demand dictate price, and our prices are increasing significantly.
Let's talk about that. About that, both rent and mortgage prices. They're through the roof. Can you throw out a few numbers?
So as a comparison, our median sales price, okay, so that's just the middle of everything that sold from March of last year to March of this year, it increased 13%. But the average sales price increased more than 20% over the same time period. I don't think anyone's income increased by 20%.
Right. And the whole benchmark is you're not supposed to spend more than 30% of your monthly paycheck on housing costs. But so many people do.
That's a good rule of thumb. And yet we have almost 1 million people in Florida who are in the very low income limits that are living on 50% or more of their income is dedicated to housing expense. They are one paycheck away from being homeless.
Let's go to some calls now on this. It's 549-2937. How do you think the state should pay for these competing priorities? Affordable housing, which is an immediate problem, and resiliency measures, which is more of a long-term issue, a critical issue, but more of an existential threat over time. 549-2937. Rusty is on the west side. Hi, Rusty.
Hi, Melissa. Good morning. Melissa, it's been said that Miami is done already, that Miami is out due to rise. But not entirely the case. There is hope for Miami in terms of its barrier islands, Miami Beach and Key Largo. So you've got to wall off Biscayne Bay and start piling up sand on Miami Beach and Key Largo. Anyway, bringing it up to our area, Duval County, the report that came out 4 or 5 years ago, which said it's going to take X billions of dollars to fortify Duval County, the intracoastal, the beaches.
Yeah, we were named the most expensive city in the country to seawall because we have so much waterline. Yeah.
Exactly. But just a grain of salt is that they calculated what's it going to take to build this wall for 100 feet, and then they just multiplied by the shoreline of the intracoastal, the river, what have you.
So, yeah, it was a theoretical cost. Yeah, yeah.
Very theoretical. Take it off the air.
Okay, Rusty, thanks. Diana Galavis, Jacksonville Housing Commission. You know, clearly people in Florida are deeply concerned about the future viability of this state over the next 20, 30, 40 years, because we know what's coming if we don't get serious about mitigation and adaptation efforts. So what do you say to people who, you know, that's their top issue and they feel like the state needs to throw the kitchen sink at it. What's your response to that, those folks?
Well, resiliency is top of mind for all of us, and it should be. And we do need to put money towards it, Melissa. The fact is that the Florida's budget outlook has improved greatly over several months, meaning more options for available that are available for lawmakers to consider, which they don't have to touch the fund. The budget forecast released on April 6th indicate that the state has moved from a projected pandemic-related deficit of $2 billion in 21-22 fiscal year down to $826 million. We're talking big numbers here, okay? But mm-hmm. that's from billion to million.
Mm-hmm.
On top of that, for the current fiscal year, economists are projecting that Florida will have a surplus of $3.5 billion on June 30th. $3.5 billion. So based on these recent budget forecasts, lawmakers have much more room to be creative with the budget.
You think they're doing the easy thing then? Is that what you're saying? They're just taking money out of a pot that is easy to raid from rather than looking for other sources?
Well, making a permanent 50% reduction of the housing trust funds is unnecessary.
Lots of calls on this. Let's go to Janet in St. Augustine. Hi, Janet. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, one of the points, there's so many points I could make of what they should be doing, but one of the things that I was reading about is that foreign investors buy up our houses, you know, repossess houses, and they buy them. They don't even live in this country, and they buy our houses, and then they rent them to us, and they make profit. I don't think that investors from other countries should be able to buy our houses and then rent them back to the citizens of this country. That's one thing I think they should do. And affordable housing. What happened to little houses? You know, people live in these big sprawling houses that take up all the, you know, they're not energy efficient. Florida is basically sinking. In 50 years, a lot of Florida is going to be underwater. And they're building these big sprawling neighborhoods everywhere, these big houses that people only use 20% of. So, I mean,
yeah,
I would love if somebody would come along and start building little energy efficient tiny homes.
You know, actually is a tiny home boomlet in Florida, Janet. But I take your point. Missy Howell, I know you're on today to talk about affordable housing, not McMansions and such, and foreign investors profiting from our lifestyle in Florida. But what about her overall perception that, you know, we don't really incentivize people to live? Let's face it, we are not incentivizing people to get off the beach. The state is going to have to absorb those costs eventually of homeowners being moved inland. And I mean, there are just so many overlapping issues we could get into in this discussion, Missy Howell. What was your reaction to her comments?
So it is true that Florida enjoys a sizable investment from foreign purchasers. We are about 25% of all foreign investment in real estate happens in Florida. Most of that happens in South Florida. Now, what is the bigger driver as far as purchases out there and demand in real estate, because Northeast Florida is such a magnet for people to be moving here, we have a demand in not only our purchase market, but our rental market as well. We are one of just a handful of cities that has been selected by real estate investment trusts to come in and acquire housing. So that demand is joined with the demand for people who want to have a primary residence to live in, have a second home to live in. We have the real estate investment trusts that are coming in and purchasing houses as well, and they're competing. Our multiple offer situation just in the last 3 months has been magnified like I've never seen before. Mm-hmm. It was quite common during 2020 that we would get, you know, multiple offers in the single digits on new listings coming on the market. Since the first of the year, we're getting multiple offers in the teens and 20s on one home. And while that sounds great for sellers, the reality is if you have 20 people making an offer on one house, only one of those offers gets accepted, and then you've got 19 people that are still out there looking for a house. We have military personnel that are transitioning into the market. They can't find a house. We have corporate people being transferred in here because we do enjoy such a nice diversity in our employment options. They come in and they're scrambling to find a house.
Yeah, I hate to jump in, but I received a news release from Zillow this morning in my email inbox, you know, the big real estate website. They say that Jacksonville is now ranked number one in their digital nomad index. People moving here who can work remotely, particularly in the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So that was interesting, correct, too, to see.
Well,
they need housing.
At one point last year, LinkedIn had us ranked as the number one area that people were searching in for jobs. So because of the ability to work remotely, and they're, you know, that coupled with, we just, you know, we're blessed with a very diverse economy that offers jobs in all income points and all types of diversity. We're not solely tourism-based like many other cities in Florida. Mm-hmm. So we really do have this demand. Nationally, 1 in 5 homes are purchased by investors. And that's just not foreign investors. That's, as I said, the real estate investment trusts, which are getting billions of dollars pumped into it as an investment vehicle from all types of investors. They have money and they're having no inventory to buy. So you're beginning to see rental communities pop up that the trusts are building. And they're called build-to-rent communities, brand new homes, and the only way you can occupy that is if you rent them. They're not for sale.
Here's a tweet from Kevin. Habitat for Humanity affiliates across Florida encourage our legislators and governor to keep the Affordable Housing Fund committed entirely to affordable housing. Lots more calls. Jason in San Marco. Hi, Jason.
Good morning, Melissa. How you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
Great. Thanks for taking my call. You know, as you know, Melissa, I call your show and listen all the time, and I am a member of the Jacksonville Symphony, but I'm also a licensed realtor in the state of Florida.
Oh, okay.
I think this is a profoundly interesting conversation that we're talking about affordable housing, which is really important and we have a shortage of. And at the same time, you're talking about the string of homes that line the Atlantic Ocean and the Gulf of Mexico. I have worked in Naples. I have worked in Palm Beach. I've worked in Boca Raton, Miami, and the people who are most at threat by sea level rise and climate change are these unbelievably expensive. And there's tens of thousands of these homes along the coast,
sure,
that are $1 million and more, $10 million. I mean, in Naples, condominiums sell for $30 and $40 million, just like in Miami. So I don't know what the solution is, but I think it's just amazing when you consider that Florida has hundreds of thousands of vacant lot acres through the spine of our state, you know, just pine woods and forest, and it's almost worthless. You know, you can hardly give that stuff away. And yeah, 1 acre of downtown Miami is selling for $30 million. And I just want to make an observation because I don't know the answer to these problems and these issues. I know we're paying for, I'm going to be a little partisan here, for 8 years of Rick Scott completely ignoring all the issues about global climate change and sea level rise. We're never going to make up for those 8 years. Those are lost. But perhaps there is something that we need to have a state commission or something along these lines where some kind of concrete plans, because I don't see how it makes sense to build a $500 million wall around Miami just so those people can be insulated until a Category 5 hurricane blows up and puts 10 feet of water in their homes. I mean, doesn't that seem a little strange? Anyway, I think
Jason,
this is a conversation we need to keep coming back to.
Yes.
And I really appreciate you doing it.
Thank you. Yes, these are the difficult choices that are going to have to be made. And let's go to Richard on the north side. Hi, Richard.
Hey, Melissa. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am in the on the north side here, and I'm watching as houses are being developed and built, and the prices are going up. And what we're having is as residents come from the more expensive areas of town, they're finding land on the north side and houses on the north side relatively inexpensive. Two major problems, though, that we're still dealing with from 2008. I think right now there are two companies. JWB is a great company. They're buying a lot of real estate, but JWB is one of them, and there's another company. Between the two of those companies alone, I think they own over 5,000 rental properties.
Hmm.
And when one company can own 5,000 rental properties, two companies can own 5,000 rental properties, and then people come to Jacksonville expecting to buy, that's part of the reason why we got 19 people waiting to buy a house, because they're all rented out, and there is no incentive to do anything but buy rental properties. There's no taxes, there's no penalties, there's no limits, and eventually what we're going to end up with is a whole new generation of economic redlining and a wealth gap that is already showing up, because you're either going to be an owner or a renter, and the only way to be an owner is to be part of a real estate investment trust with billions of dollars. We're not going to see the fallout for another 10 years, but we're headed in that direction if we're not careful.
Richard, thanks so much for all of that on-the-ground intel. So Diana Galavis, Jacksonville Housing Commission. Obviously, the Housing Trust Fund is helping a lot of people. But what about his bigger point, that there is no incentive, real incentive, for companies to create more affordable housing?
So, and I really appreciate everything that Richard had said, because, you know, there is some truth to that. Absolutely. I'm also a realtor, and I will tell you that I've helped and seen that wealth building process where someone is in, quote unquote, living in their mom's basement, and they just needed some down payment assistance. One lady that I helped, she was able to get some bond money so that she was able to go ahead and have the down payment. She is now selling her home, and she is buying another one, and she has equity, and that's how wealth is built. So we need to have these trust funds, because they do really help those people have that leg up so that they're able to get into homes, which also helps our community. It helps with job stabilization, helps with education for our children. It helps all the way around. So that's why the trust funds are so important.
So let's end with you, Missy Howell. When is this likely to get settled in the legislature? This week?
This week, legislature will close up. I believe they have two to three more days before they wrap up. So by the first part of next week, we'll know where this comes down to. To Diana's point, the trust funds allow people who are renting, who have no control over their housing expense, to get into a home. The number one way to control your housing expense is to buy a home. Because at that point, you control that. Granted, taxes and insurance may go up, but they're not going to increase at the rate that we're seeing the cost of housing and rent, including rents, go up. So, you know, once someone has that leg up with down payment and closing cost assistance, and we're talking about well-qualified buyers, right? So once they have that leg up and they're able to get into that home, not only do they create wealth from the appreciation of their real estate purchase, but as their income rises, their housing expense is not rising at the same rate. Therefore, they have more disposable income that they can contribute to a 401k or an IRA, or just have that savings account that they've never been able to really have and sustain before. So, you know, we're hoping that that the legislature will see this is really important, and we need to backtrack on this and fully fund the trust funds to affordable housing initiatives across the state. I am so appreciative of all the voices that have been outcrying from all of the realtor associations across Florida, home builder associations, Habitat for Humanity, all of these associations, all of the housing community housing authorities that are out there. We have all been yelling at our legislators, what are you doing?
And I want to thank you both so much, Missy Howell, Northeast Florida Association of Realtors, Diana Galavis, Jacksonville Housing Commission. Thanks to you both.
Absolutely. It's our pleasure.
Later, some good news for your midweek, but up next.
From the first time that we started collecting that data, we noticed that African Americans, for example, had worse outcomes for multiple cancers.
Reducing disparities in health care. We'll be right back. The stress of racism, being undercounted in clinical trials. People of color in this country have plenty of barriers to better health. April is Minority Health Month. For more, I spoke with Dr. Gerardo Colon Otero, oncologist at Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville. Hi, doctor. Thanks for joining us. Good to be with you.
My pleasure. Great to be in your program.
Let's talk about the CDC's declaration. They declared racism as a serious threat to public health. Racism as a public health issue isn't something that many Americans think about, but I know it's something that you've studied at Mayo Clinic. And as April marks National Minority Health Month, let's talk about these health disparities. How do you define this? How do you see this issue?
So health disparities had been recognized for the last 50 years. It was first recognized when the National Cancer Act was formed, and studies on the cancer outcomes were being collected, and data on racial composition of our population was collected. So from the first time that we started collecting that data, we noticed that African Americans, for example, had worse outcomes for multiple cancers. And those disparities had persisted up until the present time, although they had improved. They're not as marked as they were back 50 years ago. Over the last 20 years, they've improved some, but they're still present, unfortunately.
And the Centers for Disease Control defines this as institutional racism, that the stress of living in a racist society is affecting people's health. Do you agree with that?
So there's undoubtedly, there's no question that discrimination that had existed previously and racism that has existed and is still present in our society has a significant impact in some of the social determinants of health that are still present that contribute significantly to these disparities. So, and with social determinant of health, we talk about employment, housing, transportation, access to food, and access to health care. So unfortunately, those factors that had been present for the last 50 years in our country had an impact that is still present at this time and contributed significantly to the disparities that we're still seeing.
And
that were more evident with the COVID pandemic that made it come to more to our attention.
Right. Let's talk about what you've seen in the last year that's, I guess, exacerbated some of these problems.
Right. So the COVID pandemic, for example, had shown that African Americans represent 13% of our population, but 23% of the deaths from COVID. The Latinx population had four times the hospitalization rate as other segments of the population. And the Native American population had a much higher rates of hospitalization and mortality from COVID. And to a great extent, that had been due to multiple factors that also contribute to the other health disparities that had been in existence even before COVID.
I know something else that you look at Mayo Clinic is the need for more diversity in clinical trials. Let's go from looking backward to looking
ahead. How will those kinds of changes improve community health, and what's Mayo Clinic doing in that area?
Right. So Mayo Clinic understands the importance of addressing the disparities in our community and had been working together with other health systems in trying to address those issues. So for the last 15 years, we've been collaborating with the African American and Hispanic churches to bring healthcare education to those populations, and also with the COVID pandemic, for example, providing access to COVID testing and contributing to improving access for the COVID vaccines. We also participated with volunteers in medicine in providing access to the patient population that they served, which is the uninsured, low-income working population of Jacksonville, in providing access to research and breast cancer services. You mentioned, Melissa, correctly that minority populations have lower representation in research, and that's a real significant problem because obviously, particularly in cancer, which is what I do for my area of expertise and practice, metastatic cancers, unfortunately, are not cured at this time, most of them, and we really need the research to reach the time when we can cure most of patients with metastatic cancer, mm-hmm. and it's only through research that we're going to reach that. So it is very critical that the minority populations have access to the research that is going to bring those cures. And as an example for African-American patients with multiple myeloma, they represent about 20% of all cases of multiple myeloma, but they represent only 10% of the patients who participate in the research for multiple myeloma.
That gives you an idea. Well, thank you for your thoughts on this, Dr. Gerardo Colon Otero in oncology at Mayo Clinic. Thanks, doctor, for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Melissa.
All right. From a new vegan restaurant in St. Nicholas to the inaugural St. Augustine Food and Wine Festival, to a jazz brunch on the rooftop of the Mosh. Food is on our minds this week here at 89.9. The culinary scene on the First Coast has exploded in recent years, and we are pleased to round up all the delicious details for you this week. It's our What's Good Wednesdays, where we share positive news for your midweek. Now, historically, the vegetarian and vegan food scene in Jacksonville has been small but mighty. However, this week, an exciting new addition is already winning raves. Vegan Cafe Jack's opened Tuesday in St. Nicholas on Atlantic Boulevard. Everything on the menu is 100% vegan, and diners say totally delicious. Raw, gluten-free, oil-free options all available. We're talking bowls, sandwiches, burgers, wraps, soups, desserts, fair trade coffee, the whole ball of wax. Chef Matt Bardroff says he's thrilled to present this menu, allowing your taste buds to experience a unique and savory sensation with every bite. Now, whether you're a committed meat eater, a carnivore, whether you're a vegetarian, or maybe you're more of a flexitarian like me and some of my coworkers, just inching toward a more plant-based diet overall is good for your body and good for the planet. Even if you choose to eat one less meaty meal a week, that makes a difference. So check them out at vegancafejacks.com. Okay, more food news in a minute, but first I want to give a shout out to Code Ninjas, a new Ponte Vedra Learning Center where kids aged 7 to 14 learn how to code. Military veteran Ryan Clark opened this center. He was deployed to Afghanistan in 2008, diagnosed with colon cancer at the age of 37. He was treated and recovered at Jacksonville's Mayo Clinic. And so his new mission is to inspire kids to reach their fullest potential by teaching them how to code. That's really cool. Again, the name of that business is Code Ninjas in Ponte Vedra. Some weekend events that caught our eye this week. Sulzbacher has partnered with the BLM 5K for the upcoming second annual Black Lives Matter 5K. It's coming up this Saturday at 5 o'clock downtown at Riverfront Plaza. The race will begin with a memorial dedicated to victims. Runners can expect a challenging race route this year. They're going to shut down the Main Street Bridge. Visit BLM5K.com to register. And also this weekend, the Mosh is celebrating jazz in Jacksonville with a jazz brunch on their rooftop. This is happening Sunday. There's going to be a concert by local jazz musicians, bottomless mimosas, private tours of their courtyard and collections. So treat yourself, your mom, your sweetheart to a really fun event. Jazz brunch on the rooftop at the Museum of Science and History. Tickets at themosh.org. That sounds like a lot of fun. And please do not miss Friday's show when we speak to Chef Brian Whittington about the first ever St. Augustine Food and Wine Festival. This is also coming up in May. Our mouths are watering even just thinking about this event. We'll be talking about everything happening at this festival Friday. If you've ever been to the Epcot Food and Wine Festival, maybe down at Disney World, where you walk around that lagoon and eat and drink your way around it, they're going to be having something very similar to that at the St. Augustine Fest, along with some private dinners, some parties. It's going to be really, really cool. And I'm very much looking forward to that. That's coming up May 6th through 9th. Okay, one more very exciting announcement from the week. Our own Brady Corum. He is WJCT's facility coordinator, and he's also the son of our Morning Edition host, Michelle Corum. The Corums are pleased to announce that Brady and his fiancée, Rachel, are getting married on Sunday. So hearty congrats to Brady and Rachel. We wish you a lifetime of happiness. And thanks for everything you do here at WJCT. Now, if you'd like some good news delivered to your inbox each week, sign up for our What's Good Wednesday newsletter. It goes out every Wednesday, giving you a little bright spot in your week in what's honestly been a pretty challenging time. And if you have a shout out you'd like us to mention on the air on Wednesdays, send us an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, and we will see if we can include it in our weekly What's Good Wednesdays. There are a lot of good things happening, and we need to celebrate them when we can. Speaking of which, in a moment, we'll tell you how local volunteers on the First Coast are standing watch, protecting veterans at risk of suicide. We'll speak with the head of Jacksonville's own, the Fire Watch, and how you can join their efforts. That's next. We'll be right back.
As he approaches 100 days in office, President Biden will deliver his first speech before a joint session of Congress.
Madam Speaker, the President of the United States.
It comes amid challenges, the pandemic, an economy still in recovery, civil unrest, and international tensions. Join us tonight for live special coverage of President Biden's address to Congress and the nation from NPR News.
Tonight at 9, here on WJCT News 89.9. It took months and tens of thousands of volunteers to prove that the current crop of coronavirus vaccines worked. Scientists are working on a way to do it faster in case we need new vaccines to fight variants.
Everyone in the field is waiting for those results to give more confidence in being able to approve other vaccines more quickly and more reliably.
That story and the president's address to Congress this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, we celebrate the 50th anniversary of NPR and All Things Considered. Bill Siemering, NPR's first director of programming, who created All Things Considered, and Susan Stamberg, who co-hosted the show from 1972 to 86, will share their memories. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Politics doesn't have to be a raging fire.
It was a plea to lower the temperature on day one.
Every disagreement doesn't have to be a cause for total war.
As the president marks a political milestone, what steps has he taken to reshape and repair a country that's still deeply divided? A fact check on President Biden's first 100 days, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, veterans' suicides remain an epidemic in this country. There is help and hope out there. Right now, we want to talk about a local organization with a national reach. The Fire Watch, based here in Jacksonville, helps veterans across the country at risk of suicide. And they do it with a unique volunteer-based model. I spoke with their executive director, Nick Halland, on the recruitment drive the Firewatch is conducting right now to get more volunteers to join their efforts. Take a listen. Hi, Nick. Good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Melissa, thanks for having me on.
All right. Let's talk about what's going on with the Firewatch. You're trying to recruit more people over the next several weeks to join this movement to reach out to veterans in our area in crisis as you come close to the one-year anniversary of this program. Before we spread the word about the recruitment effort, can you remind everyone again what the Firewatch is all about?
For sure. The Firewatch, we launched it in January 2020, and it's the community's effort to end veteran suicide. I mean, as you know, Melissa, we lose about 20 to 22 veterans a day to suicide, 10 a week here in Florida, one a week in Northeast Florida, and it's at a rate of 1.5 times that of civilian suicide. So it's a real problem, mm-hmm. And the Firewatch's solution is about prevention. How do we get our veterans the help they need before they slip into crisis?
Right. And you're asking the public to join this effort. How can volunteers contribute to this? It's a community-led training initiative that you're doing.
For sure. We call it our Watch Standard Program. We believe that the best way to prevent veterans from slipping into suicidal ideation is by engaging the community. And we launched our program, again, the Watch Standard Program, on May 1 of last year. Clinically, you would refer to it as a early intervention gatekeeper program, a little bit like CPR or the Heimlich maneuver. And that's basically what it is. We have an online portal at thefirewatch.org. It's free. It takes about 30 seconds to sign up, 30 minutes to train, and it teaches you how to identify the warning signs of veterans in crisis, how to ask them if they need help, and how to direct them to the help they need. And we actually have also on that same website, thefirewatch.org, a full and comprehensive guide to all the resources available to veterans in Northeast Florida, everything from legal assistance to financial aid to mental health counseling, low cost, no cost. So mm-hmm. Therefore, our watchstanders can easily kind of take the hand of a veteran who's exhibiting these warning signs and get them to the resources or the help they need.
So you're putting the call out now to the whole community. You want to grow this group of watchstanders from 700 to 1,000 in the next few weeks, yes?
You got it. Yeah, there is a role for everybody. You don't have to be a veteran. You can be a civilian. Really, anyone who cares about veterans can take the training and become a watchstander. When we launched it on May 1st, 2020, that was right in the beginning of COVID. And so all the accessibility to the program has been through our online portal. Now we're starting to get out a little bit more to businesses, to groups in town, associations, to train them kind of writ large, the entire group, in order to be watchstanders. And we have 700, roughly 700 signed up right now. And on our one-year anniversary on May 1, we'd like to have 1,000. Why? Because scale is important in a program like this. The more out there trained to identify the risk signs of veterans in crisis, trained to know how to ask that veteran if they need help, and trained to get them the help they need, the more we think we can prevent veteran suicide.
The Florida Department of Veterans Affairs and the VA have been watching the fire watch, I guess. Is that right? Are you hoping to become a model for preventing veteran suicides nationally?
That's exactly right. So we participate as the fire watch representing Northeast Florida in the governor's effort to end veteran suicide. It's called the governor's challenge. And the VA, the federal VA, has asked about 15 states to get involved and create a statewide veteran suicide prevention program. We represent Northeast Florida. And one of the key items that we're looking at doing is driving a statewide early intervention community-led program to engage the community to get veterans the help they need. And Florida Department of Veteran Affairs is looking to our Watchstander program as a model to do that, to roll out across the state.
That's great. So how can people join the Fire Watch?
Well, they could visit thefirewatch.org. There's lots of ways to volunteer, but the primary thing we're asking people to do, particularly now, I've got to get, if I can, 300 folks to sign up as Watchstanders in the next week and a half, is to visit thefirewatch.org. Just click on Watchstanders. You'll learn about the program. You'll immediately get driven to our portal. Again, it's free. If you actually complete the training, you'll be able to download and print a Watchstander certificate. And if you give us your work or home address, we'll send you a wallet card, which reminds you of the training that you took, a little rubber wristband for Firewatch Watchstanders, which are only given out to those who take the training, as well as a sticker and a letter from our founder and our chair. So it's a pretty exciting program. It's a way for folks to take the next step beyond just thanking a veteran for their service. Now you can get trained to help keep veterans from slipping into suicidal ideation.
Yeah, a very important effort, especially in our area. So thank you, Nick. He's Nick Howland, Executive Director at the Firewatch. Again, go to thefirewatch.org and join their efforts. Thanks, Nick.
Thank you, Melissa.
Again, that's thefirewatch.org. Check it out. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers, along with producer Heather Schatz, director Josh Torres, news director Jessica Palumbo, and digital editor Bill Bortsfield. Emails are such a big part of what we do. Keep your feedback coming. Send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Catch our podcast up later today. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.